This is the Behavior Research and Therapy Podcast, where we highlight recent research findings and theoretical viewpoints in experimental psychopathology.
Welcome to this episode of the BRAT Podcast. I'm Brett Davis, a doctoral student in clinical psychology at UCLA.
I'm Olivia Losowicz, also a doctoral student in clinical psychology at UCLA. And on today's episode, we have the honor to talk with Professor David Clark and to discuss improving access to psychological therapies, or IAPT, which was recently renamed NHS Talking Therapies for Anxiety and Depression, a program launched by the government of the United Kingdom to increase access to evidence-based psychological treatments within the UK's National Health Service, or NHS.
The service was created to improve access to and delivery of mental health services for depression and anxiety disorders. The program works to disseminate evidence-based care recommended by the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, also called NICE, which is an independent organization charged with reviewing empirical evidence for treatments. The program ensures high-quality training for the clinical workforce and uses routine outcome monitoring on a session-by-session basis to evaluate results. Individuals may opt in to using the services or be referred by another healthcare provider. Based on their presenting problem, individuals receive care ranging from self-help workbooks to one-on-one therapy to group therapy, and including a variety of therapy modalities. The most common offering is cognitive behavioral therapy, also called CBT. And in 2021 to 2022, nearly 1.2 million people were able to access services, with plans for nearly 1.9 million to access services between 2023 and 2024.
We're grateful to be joined today by Professor Clark, the National Clinical and Informatics Advisor for the IAPT program, and a figure integral to the creation of IAPT. Professor Clark is an Emeritus Professor of Experimental Psychology at Oxford University, and his research focuses on cognitive approaches to understanding treatment for anxiety disorders, particularly panic disorder, social anxiety disorder, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Professor Clark has been recognized for his work with the Lifetime Achievement Award from both the British Psychological Society and the American Psychological Association. Professor Clark, thank you again for joining us.
Pleasure.
So let's see, we can kind of just start off with some questions about the IAPT program. And our first question is, what has been the most unexpected barrier to implementation of the IAPT program?
Well, I think probably the biggest barrier was my narrow focus. So as a sort of psychology researcher, I thought that, you know, if you develop treatments and you do randomized control trials and you publish them in the best journals and the results are good, then healthcare systems will want to take them up and your job is really done. And that was really the idiocy of youth. And I now realize that there's a lot more to it than that. And furthermore, if you want to persuade people who hold the purse strings for mental health budgets, whether it's governments or insurance companies, the argument isn't just that there are treatments that are effective. You need to combine that with an economic argument. And I think it took me quite a few years, plus an accidental meeting with an economist, to make me understand that the economics is really central to getting these programs funded and continued. So I think that was the biggest impediment. There's another impediment that thankfully I think we anticipated, and so we didn't find it was a problem. And that is that the IAPT program is in some sense quite radical. It makes a public promise that if you have treatment in that service, you will get the NICE recommended evidence-based psychological treatment for your condition, delivered by therapists who are fully trained to be able to deliver that treatment, and you would have your outcomes measured and the outcomes of your service would be publicly reported. This, at the time that we started, was all pretty radical. And I think if we had tried to persuade people working in our existing mental health services to move to guaranteeing delivering evidence-based treatment and having the outcomes monitored for all their patients, we would have got a lot of kickback, I think. So instead of trying to transform all of our existing services, we adopted an opt-in to the revolution principle, where we said there's gross undertreatment of mental health problems, and so there's space for something additional on top of what we already have. And so we created the IAP services, not instead of our existing services, but in addition to them. And we said to people, if you're interested in working in this way, come and join us. We'll give you all the training you need and we'll give you a job. But it was sort of only essentially recruiting the people who really want to work that way in the first place, rather than trying to do a lot of system transformation. We also didn't bother to try and get the universal support of the professional organizations for psychologists, in this case, the British Psychological Society, because we felt working to do that would probably have taken us until well after my death. And so it was just easier to get a plan, get government support, and press ahead with it with a coalition of the willing, which is people who want to sign up for that. But as many other people who've been involved in major changes in social systems, the other principle I think we adopt is give us your children. So we focus on really bringing in younger people who are very enthusiastic.
As evidence-based therapies have become more accessible through IAPT, do you perceive a shift in public attitudes and discourse relating to mental health in the UK?
Yes, very much so. But I don't think it's just because the treatments are more available. I think it's because we focus very much on the idea that a well-delivered treatment gives you a reasonable chance of recovering from your mental health problem. And, one of the metrics that we publish for each service is the percentage of patients who recover in the sense of having moved out of the clinical range for both anxiety and depression. And a lot of the publicity is about recovery rates and improvement rates. And I think that's the big thing that changes public perceptions. I see the change in stigma about mental health as being really a similar process to the change in stigma that we had about cancer several decades earlier. So when people didn't think there were effective treatments for cancer, they often didn't want to talk about it, and they felt a bit ashamed about talking about their cancer, and they often talked about the big C, not even mentioning the word cancer. But as it became clear that for many, but sadly not all, of our cancers, we can actually have pretty effective interventions as long as we get in earlier, then of course public attitudes changed enormously and people are much more willing to talk about it. And of course that's to everyone's benefit. And I think the improving access to psychological therapies or NHS Talking Therapies program has essentially been doing the same thing for mental health.
That's a really fascinating comparison. We noticed that in the event that there is more than one evidence-based treatment for a patient's presenting problem, that IAPT emphasizes that the patient should be offered a choice of therapy. And we're wondering, does patient preference affect treatment uptake? And ultimately, does it affect treatment outcome?
Well, it's been a principle that we've tried to adopt from the start. So we don't have sort of data within the system to support that. But of course, we've tried to adopt it from the start because there is good research data supporting it. So there are, a number, maybe not as many as we would like, of patient preference trials where some people are randomized to one treatment or another, but also a subset of people get the one they would prefer. And I think in general, although the literature isn't 100% consistent, you find that if people have a strong preference, they tend to get better results with the one that they would prefer. And of course, there's a much larger literature showing that treatment credibility is a strong predictor of outcome. And that does correlate pretty closely with preference. So I mean, those are the reasons behind it. And I think we think it's not just the outcomes, that people are more likely to engage in something that makes sense to them. But I should say that we only offer choice when the evidence indicates that for that clinical condition, there are different treatments which are similarly effective. So in IACT, the literature, I think, is pretty clear that there are a range of different psychological treatments that are effective in depression. CBT is one. Behavioral activation, a sort of variant of CBT, is another. Interpersonal psychotherapy, couples therapy for people depressed in the context of a relationship issue, and also certain models of brief psychodynamic psychotherapy. So we do try to offer people a choice between those. Not all of our services offer all six of those, but most of them will at least offer a choice between CBT and sort of counseling models for depression. But NICE does not recommend things beyond various forms of CBT for the anxiety disorders. So in the anxiety disorders, that's essentially what we offer.
You mentioned that you can sort of see that when patients are offered a treatment that fits their preference, that they're more willing to engage with that. Do you see that reflected, therefore, within the sort of adherence rates to the treatments that patients might be assigned that do match their preference?
Well, when we have options available in a service, they always get their preference. So we can't sort of experimentally test that within the system. But we're relying on a prior research evidence base, which suggests that.
Sure, that makes sense. So IAPT has grown significantly over the last 15 years. And with a program of this magnitude and with so many people involved in execution, how do you ensure that your standards of evidence-based practice are met? Are there, for example, ongoing fidelity checks built into the system?
So we don't have the sort of fidelity checks that you would have in a randomized controlled trial of psychological treatments, where you might video a random selection of therapy sessions and then get them independently rated. We are currently giving a full course of treatment to 670,000 people a year, and it's just not possible to do that very time-consuming type of assessment. But what we do is we have a whole series of things which intersect to ensure that therapists really stick to the evidence base. So the first thing is the public knows that, there's a promise behind the IAP program, which is that they will get the relevant NICE recommended treatment for their condition from a therapist who's properly trained to do it. So, if you work in the service, you shouldn't be doing something else. There's a public commitment there. Secondly, we have been very careful about the training for the IAPT program. So we set up national training courses for each of the different treatments, and the training courses all follow exactly the same training curriculum. And the curriculum is designed to give people the competences that they need in order to deliver that treatment effectively. We have a published competence framework, and people don't pass their courses until they've demonstrated all those skills in videotapes of actual live sessions, which are rated, and also, of course, in their essays and other assignments on the courses. But then we ensure that everyone gets supervision of their clinical cases every week, without exception, so including the more senior staff, to ensure, again, that they have a chance to keep on track. And we also endeavor to give people each year some continuing professional development training. But of course, lastly, we're recording the outcomes of everyone who's seen. So we have a session-by-session outcome monitoring system. So you fill in a simple measure of anxiety and depression and disability each time you're seen. So even if you drop out of therapy early, we still have data on you, which goes into the data set. And this system works very well. So, of the 670,000 people who had a course of treatment, which means at least two sessions before discharge, but obviously many people much more than that. We were able to get pre- and post-treatment measures on 99.2% of those people. This is obviously better than in most randomized controlled trials, and it does mean we have a complete data set. And so we can look closely at, you know, how each therapist is doing. That's an internal exercise within the service in a sort of supportive supervision network. But also we can look at how each of the services are doing, and we can pick up if any services seem to be doing much less well than one would expect, and, you know, try and explore what's going on there. Also, very importantly, and often not even published much in research trials nowadays, we also record what we call reliable deterioration. So whether someone is significantly worse in terms of their symptoms at the end of treatment than at the beginning. Because, of course, there is a literature showing that some psychological treatments can do harm as well as good. And you really should be monitoring that. In IAP, the reliable deterioration rate is about 6%. That's an awful lot less than you would get on a no-treatment wait list. So we don't think it's a problem, but we do think it's very important that we monitor it in every service so we could detect a problem if it emerged.
So how do ongoing scientific discoveries inform changes in treatment delivery and clinician training?
Well, so the obviously, when you have a national program of psychological therapies, there's a risk you get into a lot of controversy about what therapies you should support and what you shouldn't. And, you know, there are a lot of different views in our field, aren't there? So in order to try and avoid getting into bun fights, we've sort of set up the principle that we will implement whatever is recommended by NICE, the National Institute of Care and Clinical Excellence. So, of course, that means that if NICE updates its criteria and changes them, we will commit to changing what we do as well. But we won't do it on a sort of random basis just because there's one new research study or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that has worked well so far. And there have been, you know, over time, some changes in NICE guidance for different conditions. And we've, in general, then honored those changes. So, for example, in the most recent depression guideline, group CBT is given a stronger recommendation than it was before. Also, in the more recent guidance, brief psychodynamic psychotherapy originally was only recommended for the milder cases, but it now has a broader recommendation, and we're honoring that as a patient choice. Although the training is obviously more extensive for that, and so less services actually end up having staff who can support that at the moment.
Yeah, it sounds like there's sort of two steps there of getting the recommendation from NICE and then actually implementing it.
Yeah, with the training. I mean, obviously, there's an interesting area of massive development in psychotherapy at the moment, which is digitally enabled therapies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, therapies where a lot of the things that you're going to learn in psychotherapy are online, and you can study them 24/7 with some support from a therapist. And, you know, there are lots of digitally enabled therapies being developed. Quite a number of them have a bit of an evidence base, but they may not be delivering, the content of them may not be in line with NICE's recommendation. Mm-hmm. And we won't adopt those digital therapies that might have a bit of evidence for them, but are not delivering NICE recommended treatment content. So we keep the same rule, whether it's for the rapidly evolving digital therapies field or for face-to-face therapies. I think this is really essential because it means that, you know, people see the IAP program as a fair program, not one that's sort of subject to excessive lobbying by one interest group versus another.
Do you think, Professor Clark, that the success of IAP or similar models depend on a centralized or government-sponsored healthcare system?
So, of course, the IAP program itself is a in a government sponsored healthcare system. But no, I don't think it's essential to run something like that there. In fact, you know, I've had discussions with American insurance companies and insurance companies elsewhere who could all see the benefits to them of running a system like the IACT one. I mean, they're very attracted to the idea of, you know, making an offer to the people that they insure of having evidence-based treatment and monitoring the outcomes. And so that, you know, when they're employing therapists, they're not just saying, well, I will reimburse you for however many sessions you did. They can also look at whether the therapists are, you know, as effective as they hoped. And they can also focus what support they provide for their staff to address any relevant issues. So I think the principle would work elsewhere. And I know there are, you know, some countries with more insurance-based systems that are starting to adopt this approach. However, it certainly was the case in IACT that politics were very heavily involved in developing the program. So in English public life, if you want to do something big, the magic moments are in the run-up to a general election, because that is when you have the chance of persuading a political party to put the big idea in its election manifesto. And if a political party can commit to something in a general election and it is elected as the government, it feels that it really needs to implement what it committed to. And furthermore, the civil service all feel that they should work hard to help. So with the IACT program, Lord Layard, the economist I mentioned, and I really worked hard to persuade what was Tony Blair's Labour government at the time to make a commitment to starting the IACT program if they won the May 2005 general election. They put that in the written manifesto in the run-up to the election, and they did win it. So then, you know, we got on with developing the program afterwards. I should say that having made a commitment in the manifesto, when they actually got elected, they said, yes, well, we did make that commitment, but it's a lot of money. It's a big program. I think we need a bit more data first. You've shown us all these research trials and things, but, you know, we'd like to know a bit more about, you know, would it work on the ground in practical implementation? So we're not going to roll out a national program yet, but we're going to provide money for a couple of pilot sites for a couple of years. You can try and create this whole thing in two cities, and let's see how you do. We did get the sort of outcomes that we had promised the government in those pilot sites, and so we were then allowed to, you know, produce a phased national rollout. It was, I think, absolutely crucial that we built into it this commitment to collect outcome data on everyone. It sort of had to be built into it because the main argument for the program was an economic one. We said that it actually won't cost the government anything if we get it right, because if we can effectively treat anxiety and depression more or less to the sort of outcomes you get in the research literature, so around about 50% of people recovering and about 70% of people reliably improving, then the program won't cost anything to the nation, because we will greatly reduce people's physical healthcare costs. And we also will help people get back into work or be more productive in work. And that will sort of bring income into the government through taxes and reduced state benefits. Of course, having advanced that argument, it was entirely reasonable for the government to say, well, in that case, you better record the outcomes, because your argument does depend on getting certain outcomes. Otherwise, you're not saving us money. So, you know, they were very keen on us developing a good outcome monitoring system, which of course we did. But it did mean that when we get in the run-up to the next election, which was in 2010, we were collecting good data, and we could present that in this case, not only to the government that was in power at the time, which was Labour, but also to the people writing the manifestos for the other major political parties, which were the in England, the Conservative Party and the Liberal Democrats. So in 2010, we got a commitment from all three parties to expand the IAP program if they were elected. As it happens, we got what we call a coalition, two parties working together, the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives. But as they had both committed to the program, when they sat down to work out what could they agree together, I'm told by halfway through the first morning of that meeting, they'd agreed to expand IAPT. And then we lobbied again for a further expansion of IAPT in 2015 with a twist that we would develop a new strand of it, which specifically focused on people with anxiety or depression and long-term physical health conditions like diabetes, cardiovascular disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and we would bring together their physical and mental health care in a single location. And we argued there were strong economic reasons for doing that. And again, we got all of the English political parties to commit to doing that in their manifestos. So we didn't really need to care about who became the government. We knew it would happen, and it did. So, you know, that's politics, isn't it? There's another bit of politics, which is what politicians care about is voters. And so in lobbying for the program, we worked very hard with mental health charities who represent patients who have been seeing the services and asked them, you know, do you want this system? Do you want improved access to psychological therapies the way we're suggesting? And they said, yes, we really do. And so we'd written a sort of pamphlet outlining the model, which we got a philanthropist to pay for it to be distributed in a national newspaper like the New York Times what one weekend. But we showed an advanced copy of that to the mental health charities, and they said, oh, well, they'd like to do their own document, which has the same ideas, but from a patient's perspective. And they said, and we'll call it We Need to Talk. And we agreed with that, and we worked together. So we decided that our pamphlet would come out in the newspapers on the Sunday, and the mental health charity's similar pamphlet would come out a few days later in the same week, so that we could control the media for a week.
Mm-hmm.
And this was very important in lobbying the government. The other sort of political insight, if you like, is realizing that if you're interested in healthcare, it's not the Ministry of Health that runs the system, it's the Treasury. And so a lot of our early discussions with government were held in the Treasury, not in the Department of Health.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Certainly. And it speaks so well to how we started this interview, you saying that the research itself sometimes is not enough. You really have to be making economic arguments. You have to be catering to public opinion to really realize these system level changes.
Yes, I think that's right.
Switching gears here a little bit, one current criticism of the field of clinical psychology is that it doesn't serve all populations equally well. So racial and gender and sexual minorities in particular deal with higher rates of psychopathology symptoms with higher barriers to care, and in some cases, worse treatment outcomes. Does IAPT address these discrepancies at all?
Yes, it does. So obviously, the key thing is measurement. So you can discover whether you've got a problem that needs addressing. If you go on a public website, it's NHS Digital's IAPT annual reports, you could type that in Google, you will see that every year we publish really very detailed reports on the outcomes of every IAPT service, which can be broken down by a whole series of different characteristics. One, of course, that clinicians might be interested in is, you know, the clinical disorder that you have, but you can also break it down by gender, by ethnicity, by religion, by many protected characteristics, you know, various forms of disabilities and things. And it means that services can look closely at two things. One is, you know, are they getting comparable access rates from these different groups? And if not, why not? And what should they do to improve the access for the groups that are coming through less consistently? But also, what are the outcomes? And we found, you know, inequalities in both areas that we worked to address. So in terms of access, we find that we get really good outcomes with older people. This is actually a bit of the opposite of the CBT literature in the US, so it's a quite interesting distinction. But, you know, the overall recovery rate for the working age population is, I think, 52% at the moment. But for people over the age of 65, it is 65%. Quite a big difference. So we think we've got the model right for older people. But we see a smaller proportion of the older population than we do of the working age population. So there's an access problem. So we are working quite closely in all the different services and looking at what that is and how what outreach we can do about it. I mean, some of it is simply mobility to get to places and things, and bringing on some of the digital therapies can help as long as people are digitally literate. But we're working a lot with people in the old age section to try and correct that access problem because, you know, we think we can really help. If we look elsewhere, though, let's take ethnicity. So we do publish every year the outcomes by different ethnic groups and ethnic minorities. And if you look, say, in the data for 2015, we found there that we were definitely getting considerably better outcomes for the white population than the black population or than the Asian population. Now, are the outcomes for the black population and the white population are absolutely identical to the nearest decimal point. So in the last annual report, the recovery rate for the white population was 50.8%, and for the black population, it was 50.8%. Both groups are doing quite a lot better than they were in 2015. We've learned a lot in general from the data, and outcomes have improved, but we've brought the two groups up together as well. We still have the Asian group a little bit behind, but much smaller difference than we had before, and we will solve it. So I think the key thing is always to be able to collect the data so you know where there is a problem and then take action to correct it. And I think sometimes in literature, there's a lot of sort of unwarranted assumptions about, well, this type of therapy won't, you know, be relevant to this ethnic group or that ethnic group, we're going to create a completely different therapy or something. We found that that isn't necessary, that actually a lot of the issues are more to do with access to the service and ensuring that people get properly engaged. And we haven't really changed what is in the therapy, but we have changed a lot the way we help engage people. And also, you know, some of it's to do with the workforce. It often helps if you have an ethnically diverse workforce, so that people who are coming in for treatment may find that their therapist is more in their local community. And if not, they will recognize that there are therapists in the service that they're working in who are. And that is really very important. And we worked hard on that.
I'm curious if you've been able to analyze any data to see if treatment outcomes tend to be any different among folks who are able to sort of match, so to speak, on certain demographic factors with their therapists, or if that doesn't seem to make a difference.
I don't think we have that detail in the data set, I'm afraid. Well, I suppose we could look at gender, but, you know, more broad demographic features we don't have in the data set at the moment.
We'd love to turn for a moment to the idea of treatment personalization research for the next question here. We understand that using IAP data, researchers have created patient profiling algorithms that predict treatment outcomes from baseline characteristics like disability or functional impairment. Do you foresee IAPT moving towards an algorithm-based treatment selection approach?
Well, so algorithms rely on having fairly large sample sizes to work them through and validate them. IAPT does have a large sample size. So, you know, we now have a data set of well over 6 million people that we've given a course of predominantly CBT to. And that is a sort of national treasure. At the moment, it's not fully accessible to researchers. I hope that I'll be able to persuade the government to make it fully accessible at some stage. But NHS England has sort of encouraged some people to do particular projects to explore things that might be helpful. And one of the interesting workers is someone called Rob Sanders from University College London. And Rob has taken some quite large data sets, not the full 6 million, but some pretty large ones, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. And he's trying to look at, can you put together the clinical characteristics information that we have on patients with their demographic information in order to find a sort of cluster of people that don't do well? And he uses what he calls latent profile analysis to do that. And one of his nice studies, first published in 2016 and then replicated on an independent sample in 2020, is something that he calls latent profile 7. Sounds very boring. It's a cluster of people who start with, you know, initial scores that are very high on both anxiety and depression, but they also tend to have some employment issues. And you know, many of them are unemployed and on state benefits, but others have some issues with their employment. And they also tend to score moderately high on some measures of phobias, particularly, you know, difficulty getting out of the house and things like that. And you might say, well, you know, that does sound a very challenging group of people. And it is. And, you know, recovery rates for those people are about 20%. But And you'd never spot them as a coherent group because they account for less than 10% of all the people seen in IAPT in a normal randomized controlled trial. But in these large data sets, you can get it. So then what Rob did is the services in the area where I work around Oxford, there are 7 of these services, thought, well, you know, we'd like to do something to improve the outcomes of these people. So we asked Rob to send us the algorithm that he uses to identify those people. And we run that algorithm on everyone when they come in for their initial assessment. And then if they are in that LP7 profile group, we offer them a somewhat enhanced treatment. So we thought a lot about what might work best for them. And we decided that what might be good is give them still the standard treatment that we offer psychologically, but link them in at the same time to an employment advisor who is very psychologically informed and can work closely with their therapist to try and finesse some of the employment issues. And what we found so far, it's not a randomized controlled trial, it's more an observational study, is that those patients who accept that enhanced treatment, their recovery rate is 47%, whereas those people who've just gone for the standard offer, their recovery rate was 27%. So this is looking very encouraging. You know, it would be ideal to now follow this up with a randomized controlled trial, but it does look as though, you know, with a data set like this, you can identify a subgroup who do badly, and then you can design an intervention that works better for them. Do we think we should do much more elaborate algorithms than that? Well, I mean, we obviously have in the clinical model an algorithm in the sense that, you know, NICE does give different recommendations for different clinical conditions. So, for example, in PTSD, NICE does not recommend any low-intensity intervention. It says do not do guided self-help, for example, and it really only recommends more conventional trauma-focused CBT or EMDR. And so, you know, in the algorithm, that's what you get or you should get in the services. NICE actually doesn't recommend a step care model for social anxiety disorder either, because its view is that the evidence for individual specialized CBT is such that it is more cost effective than a step care model, because the lower intensity interventions, their outcomes are so much worse that actually they are also less cost effective. So the clinical model has certain algorithms, if you like, built into it. But I think your question might be more like, should you be using AI to develop evolving algorithms? And I know that's something that Michelle's very interested in. Of course, we'd be very open to that, but it's not what's happening in the program at the moment.
Other than initial treatment selection, is there any work being done to systematically recommend changes to level of care based on, for example, like poor early response to treatment beyond the first triaging or that first baseline assessment?
Yes. So I think this is part of the weekly supervision. So, you are reviewing cases with therapists on a very regular basis. And the general rule would be, if you're someone in the more mild to moderate range, you would probably start with a lower intensity intervention. It might be guided self-help. It might be computerized CBT. It might be a fairly straightforward form of behavioral activation. But if you're not showing any response, usually within about four sessions, the first four sessions, we would normally think of stepping you up to the next intervention. So that would be the main criteria, inadequate response in the fairly short term. So we would definitely not be thinking, if you're not showing any improvement, to a low intensity intervention, to give you 10 sessions of it. We would definitely say, you should be seeing some response early on. If not, we should step you.
Got it. Yeah. So more supervision based versus not algorithm based, but in those individual supervisions, making choices.
I think you might say it's sort of both, because a key feature of all supervision is it's what we call outcome focused. So the supervisor and the therapist in supervision will see graphs of the measures of anxiety and depression. And so, the thing that's going to be at the top of the conversation right at the start is, is this person showing any improvement on it based on the data?
And we'd love to end here by asking you what you perceive to be some future directions for IOPS, sort of the next steps as you see it for continuing to expand the program.
So one thing is still to get more people to have the offer of treatment, and that depends very much on us getting further support to expand the number of therapists in the services. But I think in general, that has worked well. I mean, in England, we've had quite a few prime ministers in recent years, but it is has been the case that every administration has committed to further expansions of the IOP program, whatever their political persuasion. And I think that's because it collects the data, shows that people get better. And so it's difficult not to keep on expanding it. So that's one thing. But, increased access to something is only important if what you get access to is effective. And so we're also, I think, wanting to focus on how to make the treatments even more effective. You've mentioned algorithms that could well be helpful. We've also been, a lot of research has been done from the data to give us clues about what can give us better outcomes. One thing I think that is fairly clear is that a modest increase in the dose of therapy would help. So on average at the moment, people get 8 sessions of treatment in the services, although obviously there are plenty of people who get 20 or so, that's just the average. But we have looked at outcomes as a function of numbers of sessions of therapy. And in our modeling, we think that we could move from a sort of 50% recovery rate to a 58% recovery rate if we just increase the average number of sessions by 1.5, but we were strategic about where we put that increase. So at the moment, I'm lobbying the government to get support for that. And we also find that what measures you use to track progress in therapy actually affects outcomes. So There are two standard measures, the default measures in NHS Talking Therapy Services, which are the PHQ-9 as a measure of depression, mm-hmm. and the GAD-7 as a measure of anxiety. And you know, if you improve in your anxiety disorder, the GAD-7 will go down. So it's sensitive to change in all the anxiety disorders. But it actually is pretty useless as a guide to treatment if you have PTSD, because it doesn't measure intrusive memories. If you have social anxiety, because it doesn't have anything on social interactions. If you have OCD, because it doesn't have anything on obsessions or compulsions. And so in those situations, we recommend that the therapists use the more specific measures as well in order to track progress and to target things. So like the PCL-5 for use in PTSD, or the SPIN for use in social anxiety. And what we found is that although over time our clinicians have got more consistent in doing that, it was not good early on, but it's improved a lot. We still have quite a lot of patients who have these specific anxiety disorders and their therapists are not tracking change with these specific measures. And we've recently analyzed the data, looking at, you know, what's the outcome if you're tracking change with the specific measures or not. Obviously, you need to measure outcome the same way. So we're doing it on a combination of the PHQ and the GAD. And what we found is that using the specific measures makes a phenomenal difference to outcomes. So, for example, if you're looking at PTSD, the recovery rate, if you're not using a measure of PTSD to track change and you know, target therapy, is less than 40%. But if you are using those measures, even though your final decision about outcome is the same metric, it's much closer to 60%. And you also get a very big difference on disability because of that. You get exactly the same pattern in social anxiety disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder and panic disorder. So, you know, one of our next things is to make sure that people are very consistent in using these more targeted measures. You might say, why do the measures get you those much better outcomes? And we can look at that in the data set. We've done pretty elaborate multivariate analyses where we control for every other factor we can think of. And with a large sample size, you can do that. And what we find is, firstly, if the therapists are using the more targeted measure, they give on average a higher dose of therapy. So in PTSD, it's not 8 sessions, it's 12 sessions on average if you're using the PTSD measure. Presumably because you can often get the GAD to come down early, but the therapist using the PCL-5 sees that there's still some intrusive memories and so pushes on with therapy. But once you've statistically controlled for that difference in numbers of sessions, you find there is still a big difference in outcome. So basically, the therapists are achieving more symptom change per hour of therapy if they are guided in this more specific way, presumably because it makes it easier for them to understand exactly what the therapy target needs to be each hour. So that's a sort of key additional development that we're working on too. And this is an example. I could give you lots of other ones where we've found something that matters and then we feed that back into the system and encourage people to do it. And most of these lessons that we've learned are in what's called the IAP manual, which you can download for free actually from the NHS England website. And obviously everyone in IAP gets to see it. But there are two other developments we're working on. So one is what I mentioned to you is about what we call IAP long-term conditions, or IAP to LTC. This is this program where we bring together in the same location the physical and mental health care. We think this gives us better results with people who are comorbid. So, for example, if you've had a heart attack, we got you to hospital in time and you lived, you're going to need to go through cardiac rehab. That involves quite a lot of exercise, physical exercise, to get you back in condition, to get your heart back in condition. But one of the problems there is that some people, as they start doing that exercise, actually have a panic attack and think they're having another heart attack. And so they stop the exercise and they often turn up in casualty departments. Some people, of course, after having a heart attack, just think life's over and that, you know, they're never going to be able to do what they've done in the past, and they get quite depressed. And that, of course, also holds them back from cardiac rehab. So what we're doing is we're bringing in the psychological therapists into the cardiac clinics to work closely with the cardiac nurses. And what we're finding is that then patients are much more likely to go through their cardiac rehab. They're much less likely to turn up in emergency rooms thinking they're having another heart attack when they're not, and they get better clinical outcomes. So we want to push this type of program to ensure it is there in every area of the country. And then, of course, the last thing is, you know, we're all in the middle of a digital revolution with more and more digital delivery of therapies becoming available. And obviously, we want to support that in the program, but making sure that what we support are the therapies that are optimally effective, that we'll keep on collecting data in the program so we can monitor them year in, year out on the ground, that they do deliver nice recommended content. So we have a whole framework around which therapies we will and won't adopt that are digital. But I think the key thing with the adoption is, even if we get it wrong initially, the system will self-correct because we automatically code in the data system the digital program that you were being treated with, and that's in the public domain. So commissioners can look and see, oh, with this program that came from X, it was sold very convincingly, but it ain't doing well in practice, or vice versa.
As with so many other things in this conversation, it really speaks to the power of carefully tracking data in this type of system.
I think that's really one of the absolute essences of this program. And interestingly, I work with other governments on these things. So there are versions of IAP now in Norway, in Finland, in Israel, in Australia, and in the Canadian province of Ontario. And when talking to government figures in all of those countries, it initially, at least, is IAP's ability to collect outcome data on everyone and to put it in the public domain that hooks in the politicians, because they say, well, we know mental health is a big problem, but you know, it's a bit like a black hole. You can put more and more money in it, but we don't know whether we're really getting any benefit out of it. But with this outcome monitoring system, we actually can check, you know, was the investment worth it? And that releases a lot more money than people just lobbying for insurance companies or politicians to do what we think as psychologists is the right thing.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Clark. This has been, I think, really fascinating and informative for me, at least, to learn a bit more about IAPT and all of the considerations for each of these pieces that you have for it. So I think I speak for both of us when I say thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to talk with us. We really appreciate it.
Well, it's a great pleasure. And of course, it's lovely to do a podcast for BRAT, which has been the leading journal in the field for many, many decades. Mm-hmm. And is very well edited by your supervisor, Michelle Kratz.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Behavior Research and Therapy Podcast. This episode was edited by our audio engineer, Lucas Casto, and music was composed by Grant Carey. For more episodes, follow us on Spotify or visit the Behavior Research and Therapy website. Thank you again for listening.